years come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times, somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
We have a very special upland bird hunting super show for you today. I'm Bob St. Pierre with On the Wing Podcast.
I'm Nick Larson of the Birdshot Podcast.
And I am Travis Frank from the Flush Podcast. And together we're all collaborating to discuss a brand new app from the Minnesota DNR called the Upland Bird Hunter Diaries. This is a topic that all three of us are obviously passionate about. And rather than all three of us recording separate conversations and having you perhaps listen to all three different conversations about the same topic with the same guests, we thought it might be fun to really drill our guests in person. So today, we have Bailey Peterson from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and Nate Huck, also from the DNR. And they are the ones spearheading this new project called the Upland Bird Hunter Diaries. Bob, you just returned from Washington, D.C., and I know you've had some podcasts already here about this, but I have to ask, what was it like speaking up there in front of, I don't know, how many people?
Well, there's probably 70 people for the congressional briefing.
Were you nervous?
I was until I got there, which was interesting because it was, so I was in a congressional office, so it wasn't all of Congress, just to be clear. It was 60, 70 members of staffs of Congress. And then, you know, you look in the audience and they're all 25, 26-year-old staffers. They're like, okay, I got this. You know? And the briefing that it was Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, National Wildlife Federation, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, Isaac Walton League and the North American Grouse Partnership, and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And the focus was on the concept of the North American Grasslands Conservation Act, something that if you follow our organization on any social platform for the last 3 years, we've been working diligently to get this legislation moving forward. It was actually introduced into the Senate last year, and it's stalled out this year, hasn't been introduced yet, but we're trying to rally support. We had a very high potential representative join us, Charisse Davids. I don't want to speak for her and say that she's going to introduce it, but she's very supportive. She's from Kansas. The last time it was introduced in 2022, it was introduced in the Senate by three senators, Senator Wyden from Oregon, Klobuchar from Minnesota, and Bennett from Colorado, but it was all Democrats and kind of one-sided. Issues don't go very far these days.
Do you feel like there was bipartisan support there?
Not yet. And that's the
so
that's
do
the
you
challenge.
Feel hopeful?
Not during this current session.
Okay.
But it's also one of those things we don't want to let die. So we keep pushing forward. So we'll see what happens in the elections this year, because you got not only the presidential election, you got Congress and Senate and dependent upon who's in charge, that can sway the winds different directions. So we're hopeful that keep this at the forefront. Having the Cornell Lab of Ornithology is a coup. I mean, honestly, bringing their reputation, their data to grasslands loss as part of this is head-turning, and it brought a lot of people out to listen. So that was a big portion of what I did in D.C. The other two things, which I was a little bit more nervous for, was sitting down with the chairs of both the House and the Senate Ag Committee. So on the House side, it was G.T. Thompson, Republican lead from Pennsylvania. And on the Senate side was Debbie Stabenow, Democrat from my home state of Michigan. So I sat down with both of them, recorded podcasts about the ongoing farm bill discussion to try to get a farm bill across the finish line by the end of 2023. it actually run, or I'm sorry, 2024. We're in 2024 right now.
I think so.
but the Farm Bill runs out at the end of September, and, you know, and kind of it's really in limbo, which is goes to farmers, ranchers, food stamps, and and hunters. Everything's sort of in limbo.
Did you feel like you were able to have an honest conversation with them and they gave you real answers in that podcast, or did it feel like it was what they needed to say?
Yes.
I only ask because I've had these conversations before, and sometimes I just leave, and I've been frustrated, angry sometimes before with some of the conversations I've had in the past on those political discussions.
I think all of the above. I thought, I mean, they're people just like you, in me. And some of the conversations were very heartfelt, genuine, fun. And then others, you could tell when it was political speak. And honestly, you know, I'm not Dan Rather. You know, the goal isn't to grill them. Here, the goal is to demonstrate that we have connectivity to the highest, our organization, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, has connectivity to the highest levels of discussion on the Farm Bill. That our members, you know, when they send in emails and contact, it gets heard and they take notice. So my biggest takeaway is, the conservation title, Title II of the Farm Bill, is really not the source of contention. You know, largely the House and the Senate agree on most of it. There's definitely differences, but the source of contention on the Farm Bill is more related to food stamps, nutrition, you know, things that fall outside of our purview and influence. So it's obviously frustrating. You kind of wish there was just a standalone conservation
bill, move it forward
and keep her going. But you know, that's not the case, and it gets it's hung up right now.
On a personal level, what, you know, had you ever spoken before down in DC at something like that?
Not in D.C. I moderated Farm Bill forums before with senators and representatives, and I've written speeches that I've heard my words in presidents off their lips, which is startling,
wild, huh?
You know.
Yeah.
So it was really, but it is flattering every time you get that level of connectivity, and it is a testament to all the volunteers of our organization that, you know, We have a role to play, and we have influence. So it wasn't the first time, but it was somewhat unique. Yeah. Like, it's not something I do every day.
You didn't wear the orange blazer. What the heck?
I was honestly told very specifically to leave the orange blazer at home by multiple people. They're like, dial it back, Bob.
Really? The thought crossed your mind, obviously.
Absolutely. I was going to wear the orange blazer to Congress for sure. That was my thought. And they're like, no, you got to dial it back. It's like, really? I'm like, you asked me. I mean, this is me. And they're like, no, dial it back. So I still had fun. I mean, I was still me. You know, I dropped a few jokes. I kind of floated some jokes I was gonna tell. I had a bird dog parade joke in there that I wasn't allowed to say.
Was it pre-scripted then?
They just knew that I would go further off script if they didn't get me in line.
They had to rein you in. You had a little shock collar on that they could buzz you if you started to go off the rails.
I gotta know. Did you sneak in a rooster?
I didn't. I didn't even do that.
Signature move.
Yeah. No. But it was fun still, and it was intimidating at some level, but it was productive.
I just think those opportunities to be able to go up in front of people that, you know, we talk to all the time, but it's just unique, and you know, anytime, like, you've asked me to MC the banquet, and that's an example of something that can be a little intimidating.
I mean, no doubt.
A couple thousand people there, you know, and it's always after the fact you look at it and like, that's really cool to be able to do something like that. So, but on behalf of bird hunters listening to all of our shows right now, thank you for going there to speak, because if you didn't, who would have?
Yeah, well, thank you know, ultimately the thank you goes to our members. You know, people that write checks to Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, Rough Grouse Society. You know, having people that are engaged in the politics. I mean, we all of us, I think, escape into the fields and the forest to get away from politics, DC, you know, the normal things in life that are just kind of acrimonious right now. But in order to protect the places and the opportunities and the things that we all love, to follow bird dogs around fields, forests, sage, savannas, we have to be engaged in the political process. And it's really important.
Well, we're engaged. We're together here in a group. I think 4/5 of us are pretty much grouse hunting addicts.
Full blown.
Nick. Hi, I'm Travis. I'm a grouse hunting addict. Bob.
Testify, brother.
I think Bob's earlier Freudian slip, if you will, about it being 2023, Bob is hoping to just hit repeat on the 2023 season. A little bit more to that story that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. Well, I feel like because we have Bailey here, Bailey, introduce yourself. Are you an addict? It's okay. It's a safe space.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Bailey, and I have a problem. I'm a bird dog collector, and I spend all my time hiding in the woods.
So today is actually the perfect day to launch this podcast, because today the Minnesota DNR, and specifically Bailey Peterson and Nate Huck, who are joining us today from the Minnesota DNR, are launching the Upland Bird Hunter Diaries. And initially when you reached out, Bailey, I was thinking this was strictly grouse, but is that not the case?
That's right. So let me first say this is really Nate's baby. Nate Huck just started this year as our Upland Game Bird Specialist. And it's the first time we've had this position, really. I mean, there's been various forms of it, but really exciting position. He really hit the ground running. I'm just here to keep you guys on the rails. And also, you know, to make sure our expectations of the upcoming season are, you know, somewhat in reality. But anyway, so this, the diaries will be keeping track of all the upland game birds that we might pursue here, woodcock, rough grouse, spruce grouse, prairie chickens, sharp-tailed grouse, ringneck pheasants, Hungarian partridge, and snipe. Did I miss any?
I don't think so.
Nate, welcome to the show.
Yeah,
you have worked in Wyoming, you've worked in Pennsylvania, and now you're in Minnesota.
Yeah.
How the heck did you get here?
You know, I've just been chasing the dream, and just I've always really wanted to work for Minnesota DNR. Has a great reputation across the country, and
I love it up here. Are you just saying that because
I'm pretty open and honest about things, and so yeah, I'm dead serious when I say that. Yeah, they have a good reputation. They have a great culture. And so I've always wanted to work for him and finally found an opportunity.
Well, Nate was actually my intern back in 2009
for
the DNR. So.
Holy smokes. I'm not trying to age you here, Bailey, but how long have you been with the DNR?
Since 2009.
Since 2009.
Yeah,
and you
years.
Got an intern
right
your first
away.
Year?
Yeah. Two of them.
Yeah, two. Yeah, the
two
other one.
The other,
the other one just won the National Duck Stamp Competition.
Yep,
so.
Chuck Black.
Huh. Outstanding.
Bailey Peterson, intern tree.
Like in the
legacy.
NFL, there's really only four coaches,
yes.
And everyone has come down from, you know, the Shanahan tree and the Belichick tree.
Exactly.
Then in the wildlife biology, there's the Bailey tree.
No.
Well, Bailey, how many days a year do you think you spend hiding in the forest, like you mentioned?
Oh, man. I mean, I do sit behind a desk quite a bit for work, you know, reviewing timber sales or talking to the public and, you know, lots of meetings. But I spend as much time as I can in the woods, you know, actually out assessing our habitats, managing our habitats. We're working on getting our hunter walking trails prepped for the upcoming season right now. So spending a lot of time clearing deadfalls and mowing our trails. But I have woodcock banding in the spring. That's 30 to 45 days, pretty intensive time spent with the dogs in the woods. And then, I don't know, maybe 100 days a season hunting across the country.
That's it, huh?
If I'm lucky.
What are your stats?
I don't get in the woods that much, and I will say it's not that I don't enjoy grouse hunting. It's just that I've become a jack of all trades. Moving across the country, I enjoyed chasing big game out west. I enjoyed, you know, chasing the couple of grouse that are in Pennsylvania and trying to find woodcock. I enjoyed that a lot, but I just, yeah, I tend to find that I go wherever the weather takes me on a weekend. If ducks seem like they're the best, that's where I'm going. If I got, you know, if it's late October, I'm probably going to be sitting in a tree stand, but yeah.
Love it. Well, so this is your baby. Can you really explain in depth what this app is and what your goals are? And then Nick and Bob and I will come up with some really hard questions that we'll try to stump
drill you.
Drill, grill.
Grill. Here we go.
Yeah, happy to do so. So I guess first I got to give a shout out to my counterparts in New York, Josh Diller, and in Pennsylvania, Raina Tile. So this is kind of something that I modeled after the things that they're doing already. These are, you know, they're out there recording their rough grouse and woodcock data, and I really thought that was something that we should be doing here. You know, maybe my first week on the job, somebody asked me about woodcock season and whether or not we thought we should be changing the dates to match the grouse opener. And my first question was, well, what does our upland bird hunter diary data say about flushing or about, you know, migration timing? Like, are we matching up pretty well? And realized we didn't have it and started kind of down that route of, okay, well, what's it going to look like if we bring this here? Because it is different. We have a whole mess of other species and other issues that are that we want to kind of record as part of this.
So out in New York, how long has this diary system been implemented?
I'm not sure those two states how long they've been doing it. For quite a while, though. They've been kind of checking. Yeah.
So the genesis of this concept was the question about matching up grouse and woodcock season in Minnesota.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of a hypothesis on what the general public wants?
No. And that's part of the problem too, is, you know, and you get this in every aspect of hunters, but nobody, you only hear from those people who are unhappy. Mm-hmm. And so I don't hear from very many people. So maybe everybody's pretty happy, but it seems like there are a large contingent that want to be shooting woodcock on opening day of grouse season. And there's a large contingent that enjoy chasing woodcock later in the season, you know, further south. So
let's take a quick survey.
it's tough to keep everybody happy with a migratory bird that is dependent on the weather. Yeah. So imagine hunting the last few weeks of October, and the woodcock season is closed and that's when the migrations come through. Mm. You guys would be ticked. But alternatively, we have the people on grouse opener who can't. And then we have the magical years where they do match up, which only happens every four or five years. Mm-hmm. And that's cool. But, you know, most woodcock hunters, are traveling to the northern part of the state to hunt. You almost always have opportunity in the southern part of the state to hunt, you know, finish out the season if the migrations have already come through in the northern part. So
what are the season dates right now in Minnesota for grouse and woodcock as it stands?
Well, generally speaking, so I think this year grouse is going to come in on September 14th, and then woodcock will come in on September 21st. And then woodcock runs 45 days straight, so ending sometime in early November.
And that generally matches what Wisconsin does, generally, not always. And then Michigan always happens September 15th, and it always pairs up with woodcock season. So you can see there's some differences very near states bordering each other.
For sure. And you can blame Michigan for this problem that we have because they were the ones who advocated for moving allowing woodcock season to be open earlier. Mm. So historically, it wasn't able to be open any earlier. But that was a change that happened recently, and that's where the controversy has kind of come from.
Any earlier than what, like September 20th?
I believe prior to it, It's now a fixed date of September 13th, I want to say. But prior
cannot
to that,
be earlier than
cannot be earlier than it. September 13th. But prior to that, it would have been, yeah, probably the third Saturday in September.
Do you, anybody in this room recall Woodcock being open on September 1st?
No.
Oh, I mean, I've read about it.
Because I got an old-timer buddy of mine that he talks about that, and I don't know if it's something that he's just misremembering.
Aligned with the snipe season. Snipe season does open September 1st.
Yeah. Certainly not when I was chasing Woodcock.
I do. I mean, as a kid growing up in the UP, I always, you know, had, well, not always, because there was a little window there where they separated the two in Michigan, grouse and woodcock, but generally having them dovetail together was pretty terrific because, you know, you've waited all these months to get out there and, you know, it's a jungle on September 15th and you get an opportunity at a woodcock and you can't get in the game. It's like, but to your point, Bailey, there's been some years that right before deer season, you know, if you have a mild fall leading up to kind of the close of woodcock and you get that just monster wave of the migration. Like I can remember, I guess it would have been like the Friday before deer opener and this woodcock season was like winding down and I had 60 points on woodcock, and had the season been synced with grouse, that wouldn't even have been. I mean, I still would have got the points,
right?
But you wouldn't have been able to.
Absolutely.
Maybe we need to verify that this is a federal date, and the limits are set federally, not by the state.
The period of time,
45 days. Yes. You can pick the start and finish.
The states choose when it starts and ends.
Yeah, and I think that's something that people often get confused a little bit because that's not something that we deal with in the upland game bird realm, except for woodcock.
Yep.
And so, well, and snipe. But these are federal frameworks that basically dictate the earliest opening, latest closing, which doesn't impact us in Minnesota, but there is a cutoff, and the total number of days and the total daily bag limit.
Now, when you get your small game license in Minnesota, it asks you, you know, when you do the survey, the questions.
HIP certification.
So it asks for snipe, coot,
rails.
Gallinules, did I say that
right? Gallinules, yeah.
Gallinules. I can't say that I've ever for sure seen a gallinule. I don't know.
If I did, I didn't know what it was.
I have not shot at snipe because I wasn't 100% certain that it wasn't, that it was exactly what I thought it was.
Right.
You know, so it's something that I want to do and I want to understand a little bit better. Does anybody in this room, have any of you hunted for any of those species that we get asked about every year? Bailey?
Rail only occasionally as like, but oftentimes I haven't fired at them because I have like duck loads in and rails are half the size of a woodcock or smaller. They're really tiny. They have a huge bag limit. What is it? 25.
Yep.
25.
Does anybody hunt them? Does anyone ever?
There is. So I know there's a, Dave Kremitz, the woodcock researcher out of, I want to say Arkansas. He has a place up in Cass County and he is a rail fanatic. And really? I think he's got some YouTube videos out about rail hunting specifically, but you'll often see him just around the, ringing around the edges of like wild rice marshes. Snipe is kind of another one of those bucket list species that people just will check off. And I've seen them pheasant hunting. I've seen them woodcock hunting.
Yeah.
When I was trying to ptarmigan hunt in Colorado, my dog went on point on a willow bush. Like 10,500 feet elevation. It was a snipe.
Come on. No water around anywhere?
No.
What the heck?
No.
Wow.
So they're pretty widely distributed, but not heavily targeted.
We did film a snipe hunt 2 years ago. Bill Shirk did down in Florida. They were on an airboat. And I
much
think that,
more common.
That would have been. Yeah, that's a common thing down there. But up here, I only know a couple people that do it. And typically on a dry season when you can walk those mucky edges that dry out between the cattails and the water, that's where they're finding them. And I haven't done it yet, but I think, speaking of rails, I don't want to get off the rails here. Let's get back to that.
Too late, Travis. Yeah, too late.
Let's back, Nate, focus. And Bailey, you're supposed to keep us on track. Back to the diary.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what it is now that we know that other states have done it.
Right.
Yeah.
bring it into Minnesota, and it's launching today, and it'll be available to all of us upland bird hunters. What do you want us to do and why?
Yeah. So really what I want you to do is when you're sitting at your tailgate, when you normally would write down in your diary that you're probably already keeping, recording your how many birds you harvested, your flushes and things like that, I'd like you to pull out your phone then really quickly after and record that same information. I think for most of us, like, this is information that we're generally going to be recording anyway. I'm just looking for the date. I am looking for a location because, unfortunately, we have some really big counties in Minnesota, and it's not specific enough for you to tell me that you're in St. Louis County when you're hunting. So something a little more specific than that, whether it's, you know, the app itself is going to let you record a specific location. You don't have to be afraid of giving me that. Like, this isn't going to be publicly accessible data where I'm not, you know, I'm the only one who's going to see it. But we're looking for your location, and then I want to know if you're on public or private land. You know, a lot of us hunt those timberlands, you know, those private timberlands. We're kind of just lumping those in with public. But I want to know if you're on a WMA. I want to know if you're on a walk-in access area. If you're chasing pheasants down south, I want to, you know, what number are you on? You know, that can really help our walk-in access coordinator with some of that information. A big one, I want to know if you're hunting with a dog. It's helpful to know. Some people don't chase birds with dogs, and generally we know they aren't necessarily as efficient.
What about breeds?
I think we could probably, you know, just by the number of birds bagged or flushed, we can assume.
Yeah. And here we go.
We'll be able to tell. Do you document the hunters' names then as well?
Yeah, I'll be asking for the names up front. Yep, in the app, and mostly just to keep track of who you are, to have some consistency over time. I am going to ask for an email just so I can fill you in on what the results were, and to remind you next year. Hey, don't forget we're doing this, and I'd like you to submit your data. And I'm also going to ask for your home zip code. We're interested in seeing how far people are traveling. You know, I don't want your address, but I want to know kind of how far you're coming.
So as a hunter that maybe gets out regularly, somebody listening says, I don't want the DNR thinking, hey, am I over my limit? You know, anything like that, that might skew them from being completely
worrying about hot spotting.
Worried about, yeah, exactly. I think this day and age, people are trying to be as secretive as possible typically. So do you worry that you're not going to get all the information that you really are after?
I do. I it's a concern of mine. And it's, I mean, yeah, there's a couple of people that have asked me this question. And I guess I don't have anything other than to say this is kind of the level of data that we need to be able to estimate these things. And so, you know, if you're uncomfortable with a specific location, you know, giving me a distance and direction to a nearest town is fine. I don't want to know where you hunt, frankly. It's just really easy on the app. It's going to tell you, it's going to mark your location. So it can save you some time rather than writing that in.
Right. So are you able to submit the elements that you want to submit and pull back on the things you maybe aren't comfortable with and still submit a, you know, hey, I saw this number of birds, but I don't really want to tell you exactly where.
Yeah, and like I said, you can just give me that distance and direction to nearest town. I just need something so that I know that you're not
generally,
you know, in a part of a county. That's all I'm asking for. And so, yeah, if you're really uncomfortable with that location data, don't give it to me. I don't, you know.
There's other benefits to learning this information as well. Charlotte Roy, our grouse researcher, she was on your podcast, Nick, not too long ago, and she mentioned for the last 4 years or so, we've been recording our brood sightings for like rough grouse, spruce grouse, and woodcock. We also, you know, take note of those other broods that we see, but primarily for rough grouse broods. But we aren't doing anything with that data yet because there's pieces missing. But if we know that these hunters in, you know, this half of St. Louis County are spending this much time hunting and this is how many birds they're flushing, we might be able to associate that data with the brood sightings that we've been seeing, the foresters, the trails guys, us wildlife folks, all, and then the other agencies are participating in these brood surveys. Like, so you guys could be helping us provide more data for these, you know, different surveys. We already know that the rough grouse drumming counts aren't necessarily tying into the number of birds in the bag every fall as, you know, they had been in previous decades, like for the last couple, you know, maybe the last 20 years or so, they just aren't tying in as much as they used to. And there's just a big hole in that data. And it's just a big question mark because we don't have an answer. So we always like to collect as much information as possible. And now if we have the opportunity for all these bird hunters to provide this information, it could really help us. And we have also in the Northeast region, the last 2 years have had a hunter walking trail, like camera study. So like a creel survey, sort of like what fisheries does to see who's utilizing the lakes and in like, you know, basically what their, not success necessarily, but just like, are they happy with it, what their satisfaction level is?
Is there somebody in a parking lot waiting with a clipboard?
No. So this, our camera study was just who's utilizing hunter walking trails, and then, but we kept them up throughout the year.
Do they have big smiles on their face as they're walking?
We realized that people are using these trails not just during the small game season, not just during the hunting season.
Is it like a trail camera?
Uh-huh. But all year long. And so,
do people know that they've watched?
Yes, everything's posted. It has to be.
Got it. There's Bob again.
And up in my area, I did have some... Like,
why is Bob hunting without a shirt today?
And it was really interesting because you could you could identify dog breeds or whether they were hunting without a dog and things like that. But no, the only time you could really see if they were successful is if they were like carting a bear out of the woods or something. But we saw that people were using these trails a lot, and some trails are really remote. It's like, does anybody even come here? We don't know. But if we can identify use, we may be able to leverage funding. I mean, we're all fighting for the dollars to maintain our facilities and our resources. So to know that people are up here and using these places and, you know, they're successful, then, well, maybe our management is working. Or maybe we should, you know, try to see if we can allocate some more funds to these particular types of facilities because people are successful and they're using them a lot.
You mentioned the creel surveys at the lakes. I mean, there are thousands of lakes in Minnesota, and most of the time if you go to an access, somebody's sitting there looking for weeds on your trailer and asking you a couple of questions. They have a clipboard and they write it down. It might be a lake association. It might be a parks, but it sometimes is the DNR. I don't think I've ever seen a DNR biologist at a walk-in or a WMA parking lot asking any of those questions. Is there a reason why?
Historically, there's been a lot of folks who check bags for waterfowl during like waterfowl opener on like especially on the pretty big duck lakes, but other than CWD sample stations, we're not spending a lot of time out surveying.
Relatively,
hunters.
There's probably a lot of lower traffic area hunting areas versus a lake, a very popular lake or something. But as you point out, you know, a lot of lakes, you see them pretty regularly.
Right. There's a lot of information being gathered there, which obviously is used to help, you know, understand, do we need to adjust limits or fish sizes on those lakes? Nate, back to the diaries here. Big picture, when you get this information, what is it going to do for you?
Well, I think, and one thing I'll point out too, in terms of the maybe lack of DNR at parking lots and things like that, it's just generally not been how we've tracked things over time. We have a really good way of estimating through our small game hunter surveys or other ways of estimating harvest, so we don't have to do it at that fine scale that's done at the lakes, which could be a lot more difficult for fish folks. But for the diary itself, yeah, I mean, looking at those flushes and birds bagged, I'm really hoping for just kind of another index. You know, one thing that's always great is having multiple streams of data coming in to give you a better picture of what's happening on the landscape. Our, you know, booming ground surveys, our rough grouse drumming counts, they only tell us one snapshot at a time on breeding effort. They don't really tell us how the breeding effort then kind of came around, which is why, you know, Charlotte had started that, the brood survey that she had started. We have brood efforts on pheasants and turkeys as well. But, you know, the actual trying to relate it to what hunters are going to experience in the year, this is another one of those indexes. And so hopefully we can track that over time alongside that other one.
And for clarity, we've talked a lot about rough grouse, woodcock, and you did mention, I mean, this is for all upland birds in the state. So, you know, as the seasons get going here into October, you want to capture pheasant hunting success as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, and pheasants makes it a little easier because, you know, we're in the case of rough grouse and pheasants, we are actually going to be, for those people comfortable doing it, asking for sex and age. It's a lot easier to sex and age a pheasant since obviously
you're hoping for 100% males, right?
Yeah. I'm really, yeah, I think I even have it in the app that you can't enter a female, so just don't tell me.
One falconer we might have in Minnesota who can harvest a hen, but otherwise.
And you can, and in the app, you know, you say you have a great mixed bag day, you can record multiple different species on the same hunt, correct?
Yes, correct. Yeah, you can, I mean, you know, theoretically, if you're over in Red Lake WMA and you decide to take a big long walk and harvest a sharptail and harvest a ruffie and harvest a woodcock, yeah, I can get all that.
Red
can...
Lake WMA, you say?
I don't think I'm hotspotting with that. It's a pretty big area. I'm sure Charlie will appreciate me.
So the for listeners, we're recording this obviously in advance of the day this is going to come out. We have seen this paper sheet. Bailey has it in front of her. I've got it here that you could have in your truck theoretically and fill it out. But we're obviously referencing the app a lot. We have not seen the app, and it kind of got the wheels turning. I'm thinking like Bob's question initially was my biggest question. This is the first year of this, so we're obviously looking for participation. I think we're all here to try to highlight what value this could bring. And but until we see some of those things and how this information is used, maybe that won't be as much of a motivating factor for everybody. So if we want people to participate, what are the things, as I review this and look at it, that may be friction or cause somebody not to participate? That location one being one that just obviously jumps out at you. So I'm kind of curious, and Bob already asked the question, can you submit it without that piece of it? And if not, what flexibility do you have? So you can just add a description of a direction to a town. Can I take a pin and move it around so it's like in the area on a highway or something, but not exactly at the cover that I'm at? What are the ways that we can sort of, without disauthenticating the data, like still making it relevant, but maybe giving the user a little bit more peace of mind as far as what he or she is submitting?
Sure. Yeah, and totally fair. And if you want to enter the distance and direction nearest town, that's easy enough. If you want to move the pin 5 miles away, that's not going to change my analysis in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, move it wherever you're comfortable. Don't move it, you know, don't move it to Duluth if you're...
if we're, and yeah. That's a great point. Like, if we're participating, we clearly want to add value. We want to help. But again, moving it to a highway nearby within the same distance, if that's still valuable to you, then I think that helps maybe, again, give the person submitting the data a little bit more peace of mind.
It's interesting, too, I think about what this could uncover. And I'm thinking about, you know, there's folklore of rough grouse populations being in the driftless area in higher numbers than maybe some of us believe, right? It'd be really, it could, you know, influence or inform habitat management in parts of the state where it's like, oh, my goodness, I didn't realize we had an opportunity here that now the hunters are showing us. I mean, that's probably a level of hypothesis that's involved in this too as well, isn't it, Nate?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there's always that potential that we could, you know, learn something that we weren't expecting for sure. When I think about rough grouse in the Southeast, that's something when I first started that I think about a lot. I think, you know, we have some forestry management challenges down there that would make it really difficult to, you know, but I was doing the same thing. They're trying to find their couple of rough grouse that they have left and trying to figure out ways how to monitor them. So for certain, like that's a potential benefit of this as well, that we could learn more about that. I'd love to know where people are chasing hunts,
so
where they're seeing them.
You get this information. Give us an example of a real life application to using the information. What would be something that you might learn that would then change how something is managed to benefit what we all want, which is better habitat, more birds?
Sure. I think, well, I'll point to the woodcock thing first and foremost. You know, potentially altering those seasons after we have a little more information is you know, the easiest one to tackle. I would say we're probably not going to see changes. You know, I look at things, and so maybe Bailey would be better at answering the habitat question. I tend to look at things from the regulatory side. That's where I sit. And so, sitting or monitoring, you know, drumming crowds over time. But if we were to, heaven forbid, see, you know, declines in drumming counts and, you know, declines in flush rates and declines in birds bagged, you know, we could always change bag limits and things like that as a result of this data. That, I mean, we could see it go the other direction too, theoretically, although upland bird hunters are a happy group of people. And so I think it's kind of
noticing.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time in waterfowl, and it seems like a lot of waterfowl hunters, you know, they can be frustrated with various aspects. And I think it's because we're trying to squeeze every last ounce of opportunity out. And upland bird hunters don't seem to need to have that every last ounce of opportunity to squeeze out, if that makes any sense. Yeah. Not looking for higher bag limits, because generally speaking, you know, bag attainment isn't there. But on the habitat management side, yeah, I think Bailey would be, you know, some potential.
Care to add, Bailey?
To how the public is utilizing the public land opportunities that we have is always an important thing to learn, and it's not something that we necessarily are surveying for right now. We don't surveying the public through traditional methods is sort of expensive, so we just don't do it super often on a broad scale.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a randomized type survey, and we've always known that, like, spruce grouse populations are sort of estimated spruce grouse hunting is just a byproduct of rough grouse hunting. We know almost nothing about that particular species.
There's probably only a handful of people that really understand that bird in northern Minnesota to begin with.
Right. So through this, we may be able to find out, you know, how many folks are seeing out there. We wouldn't know what they were particularly targeting that day. So if spruce grouse is another one of those bucket list species that people come to Minnesota to hunt. It's the, what did I say, that furthest east? The easternmost population that's huntable.
Yeah.
So, but when I'm doing my spruce grouse surveys every spring, I'm seeing tons and tons and tons of rough grouse sign in there. We don't know like why necessarily, except that it's a great place to spend the winter. But you know, we might be able to find out if they're there in the fall. It just, and the hunter satisfaction, you know, plays into how much effort maybe we put into managing. We don't manage for one species specifically, but we know that people like trails. And so maybe we could, you know, focus an area and more hunter walking trails, things like that. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities. There's a lot more opportunities than there is funding to do things. So
yeah.
Ideally we could see if, like, there's a shift in people's perceptions, and then, you know, try to make a change.
So one thing that is just sitting on my mind here, you know, you went through all the questions and things that you want people to enter here. I think a lot of bird hunters like to just be able to go and disappear in the woods and not be tracked. I think if they're being tracked, they might be less willing to provide this information, or if there's an option to be anonymous without entering their name. I'm going to give you the data, the information that I learned out there, but I don't want you to follow me. I don't want you to be attached to me, potentially. Some people are going to be fine with it, but I think some people won't want that information available, that the DNR then has my information, knows where I'm hunting, and can contact me. I don't know. I think that might prevent some hunters from wanting to participate. Have you been able to talk with your other coworkers in other states that are doing this to find out, you know, what worked for them? What are they still challenged with? Are people participating? And maybe I'm wrong for thinking that, but that's just something that comes to mind. I don't know, guys, how do you feel about it?
I think that's another one of those obvious low-hanging fruit, not exactly the right way to put it, but that's a question that immediately jumps to mind is, my data is now tied to me, mm-hmm. versus being able to submit it anonymously, like is done with some other things. I'm thinking Loyal Order of Dedicated Grouse. They do an anonymous survey that collects a lot of the same data. And, you know, I think about I think, do you have experience in Pennsylvania? I think they do flush counts. And there, again, there was a big motivation because they were seeing some pretty dramatic things happening with their grouse population. Excuse me. We're not exactly seeing that here. But again, until people appreciate the value of what this could provide us, there's going to be these hurdles. And right. Those questions are absolutely going to be asked. So, yeah, I would agree that that would be something that I would think of and wonder about what are the possibilities of potentially participating in different ways if our goal is participation.
Sure. I think I understand the concern of being tracked, but, you know, it's not the intent. It's not how the data is going to be used. I can, you know, point to, I do have some my experience in Pennsylvania and talking with Raina. I mean, the folks really enjoy participating in that. You know, you do get a report at the end of the year so you can see how other people did. And I can't share that with you if I don't know who you are. And I can say to the point where, you
so
know.
So I'm going to know how Bob did?
No. Actual no. And that's the thing. Like, yeah. It's not going to be reported out at that level either, you know. County level, or we'll have to see, you know, find a way to handle something like St. Louis County. But that's probably the coarseness of the data you're going to see that type of thing reported out at. And I will add that, you know, in Pennsylvania, people have really enjoyed getting those reports back to the point where I know that they've, some folks, you know, the requirement to get the report back is to submit your data. And hunters who have aged out, who are no longer able to hunt, are still writing in letters saying, hey, I didn't hunt, but could you please send me your report just so I can see how folks are, yeah.
They're just curious as to how the hunting season is going?
Yep. Even though they can't participate anymore, they were just interested in seeing how things, you know, went.
Do you know, percentage-wise, the amount of upland bird hunters that are out there hunting and then how many participate? Any guess as to, is it 10%, 50%, 75%?
Yeah, I don't even have that to know for sure, no.
I think overall, this is an interesting conversation, though, right? Because you think about, you know, there's always going to be a somewhat, I don't trust the government mentality, right? We have a similar app at Quail Forever called Bobscapes that's done in partnership with Working Lands for Wildlife and University of Georgia, and it's just to monitor whistling. Where landowners and people hear whistling, and same concerns, you know, if people are, you know, hitting, I heard these whistle counts on these WMAs,
right.
You have significant concerns about hot spotting, right? But on the flip side of that, you think about how much that undercurrent of, well, the DNR doesn't know how many birds are out there on the land, you know, so what the blend here is the DNR is actively engaging citizen science, which never even existed 10 years ago, right? That the DNR is proactively saying, hey, help us. Like, 'cause you think about the pheasant index and August roadside counts. Well, that does tell a more complete story than is capable of telling on rough grouse. So this new tool, it's not the end-all, be-all, and I don't think that's what Nate or Bailey are saying. It's not going to be the end-all, be-all data point, but it does help round out the story a little bit. And it's like, yeah, there's going to be significant amount of hesitancy. I feel it too. I mean, I started asking, like, I don't really want the DNR following everything, like, because it is a level of escapism, like, come on, like, just let me do my thing, you know? A big brother's always watching, you know? There's cameras at trail camps.
I didn't know there were.
They know where I'm hunting without my shirt on.
Bob walking through the woods.
For defense, there's no bullet on that sign that says no shirt, no shoes, no hunting.
You can hunt how you want.
However I want.
Yeah.
But anyways, the point is, like, it is an active effort to bring in another layer of data to tell a more full story. And, yeah, there's going to be, I think, a level of adoption, some hurdles that you're going to go through. You're cognizant of that, Nate. But this probably evolves over time. It can get polished over time. Kind of the point is, like, hey, we are these natural resources, these birds are the public's resource. DNR is charged with managing that public resource, and they're actively saying, help us.
Yeah, tell us this a little is more supposed data. To be fun. I mean, this is for this. Imagine this is the equivalent of posting a tailgate picture on Facebook. This is, we want to know what you're seeing out there. If you want to share the information, and it's completely voluntary. Nobody has to fill this out. So we just, for those who want to share that information with us, we welcome you to do that. And know that you're providing some important information for us to utilize.
It feels like there should be a reward system at some level, right? Like the next phase of this is, you got a limit of grouse? Holy mackerel! Like, here's your...
I'll print out some stickers and bring them over. By
I would like a sticker. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm just saying. Like,
I
it's
was
going to
ask if we could see the prize list for most flushes.
Yes. Right? So I... Something similar to this, I work with fisheries in the state here as a citizen work group. We get together, I don't know, quarterly, something like that, and we're currently working on a long-range plan. And there was a survey that went out to anglers in Minnesota, and beforehand, a couple of your, I guess it would be your coworkers technically, on the fisheries side, they sent me the survey, and then there were some certain criteria before an angler could enter it. And I said, if you send that out, you're not going to probably get very many people to submit, because they had to go through creating an account within the DNR site in order to enter the information. And I said, how often do you get sent an email and you're interested in something, but as soon as you have to create an account to see what that is, you stop the process? I don't create accounts on different sites unless, you know, there's some specific reason why. And I said, I just think you're not going to receive the information that you're trying to gather if you force people to create an account within the DNR site. And he said, well, that's just the way it has to be. And I was like, but then you're not going to get your information, in my opinion. And then they asked a bunch of other people too. And then everyone said, I'm not creating an account. And they did just like a trial on it. And everyone's like, I'm not creating an account. So they said, well, if you don't create an account, then we don't know if you're going to be answering the survey 100 times. One person, you know, skewing the data. Well, ultimately, they eliminated creating an account, and they didn't get skewed data. They got real authentic feedback from anglers throughout the state. And it was, you know, an alarmingly successful amount of information that came in, like thousands of people submitted to this survey. So the reason I'm asking this is, you know, you're telling us all the information that we need to add. Us bird hunters are saying, well, I don't know if you're going to get all that, because just knowing hunters, knowing my friends, knowing what people sometimes think and how they operate. Is there a potential that this gets modified, or is there a work group where you say, you know what, we're not quite getting it, and maybe this is why. Maybe people don't want to share their name, and if we eliminate some of these questions, we can get more information. People are going to be honest with us if their names aren't attached to it.
And you don't have to. I mean, you could write Daisy Frank and fill it out for your dog, but that when Nate sends you an email, yeah, it's going to say, hello, Daisy. Thanks for providing this information. I mean, yeah, we're not asking for social security number, your Minnesota DNR number. Like, this won't be tied to any sort, like, this won't be tied to you as a hunter in any more than just this very simple database that, I mean, and I was playing with the app, just yesterday. It's very simple, very simple.
Cool.
You know, when we contact people in January, February to ask how their season was, things are greatly exaggerated, either positively or negatively, I think, because you've had a lot of time to mull over, you know, all those birds you didn't see that you thought you might, or if it was just a really amazing year, it got more amazing as you like reminisce about it. And this is a way to,
the bird gets bigger, the fish
gets
bigger.
Yes. Afterwards. This is the way to figure out, you know, in real time, like I think you'd said earlier. So,
and I'm not trying to suggest that what you're doing isn't going to work. I'm just, you know, I said at the beginning, we're here to drill you. That's our job. We're citizen hunters.
We are used to it.
Yeah, so. I know you are. I know you are, which might segue into, I think, a topic that we have to get into, Bailey, because you spend more time in the Grouse Woods than maybe anybody else, or very few people might spend more time.
I think she said 100 days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hunting, that's hunting. But I want to know what you're seeing on the ground, because the DNR report about the drumming count this year, and Nick, you've been talking about it on your show, and Bob and I have been probably talking about it a little bit on ours as well. The reports came out, and I'm getting texts from people that are sharing screenshots of drumming counts are up, and you know, record numbers and all this other stuff. I'm like, whoa, 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 pump the brakes, because drumming counts happen before the birds nest and before the eggs hatch. And we had some major events happen in the state. So, Bailey, I really am curious as to what you're seeing on the ground. But before we do that, we haven't actually told people where they can go find this app. So we need to do that, and then let's transition. Nate?
Yeah, the easiest way to do it is going to be to go to the Minnesota DNR website and just search for the wildlife observation things. It'll be paired with all the rest of our wildlife observation stuff there.
If you go in the app store on your phone, is it going to be available there?
I don't think it will be. You'll have to, at least the first time, you'll have to go in and just click through the link, and it'll say, do you want to open it, you know, in the app? And then you can download the app, and you'll have it there.
So you want to go to it on your mobile device,
ideally. Yeah, okay. If you want to do it on your phone. You will have a web entry option, okay, for those people who don't want to do it on their phone. If you record it all on your paper diary and you want to enter it on January 15th, you know, that's fine. You can do it that way, too.
And the name, again, is the Upland Bird Hunter Diary. So if you Google or search that on the DNR website, you'll find what we're looking for.
Yeah, I sure hope so.
Safe to say, we will all have appropriate links in our show notes of these three episodes as well, too. So,
all right, okay. Grouse. Drumming Bailey. Counts.
Drumming. Are they going to match? Is it a record season? Because a couple years ago, the reports were up, and then the spring reports were up. When was that, Nick?
2017.
So everyone's all pumped, and then everyone's cursing DNR once they hit the woods. What the heck? And then past year, it was drumming counts weren't that high, but it was maybe one of the better hunting seasons in at least my lifetime. Bob, I know we've talked about it a few times. It was a great
yes. 2023 season. Was memorable.
2023 was,
and is I'm sure Bailey's going to jump in here. The mm-hmm. drumming counts were, I think, the highest of any of our lifetimes. I think it's 1972, and I'm guessing I'm the oldest, and I was born in 73, so I could say that effectively. Yeah. Highest drumming counts in our lifetime. So
will that translate? Yeah, will that translate, Bailey?
Yes, that obviously was a big headline, and there was a lot of text also in that report that, you know, didn't make the headline.
Right.
The headline would have been kind of boring if it was Charlotte's caveat that read, the age of DNR staff had been increasing. We had a lot of retirements. Now we currently have a lot of younger staff. And so we're making an assumption that they can hear better. So is that why drumming counts are increasing? Because we have a lot of fresher, younger ears that are listening for the drums.
What?
Yeah, right?
It's actually a really good thing that I don't do drumming counts, because it would be zero every single time I come back. Travis hears nothing.
It is. I mean, it was a factor, but over the grand scheme of things, did it play into the percentage? Probably not. But then there was the also the warning of the spring weather, because by the time that the drumming counts had been released in July, we had already had a very wet June. So there was a sentence or two in there about you know, wet and cold weather playing an effect on.
I think that was paragraph 4 of the press release.
Yeah.
But people got really hung up on that. Yeah. On that first sentence.
You know, there's so many factors that come into play that aren't really something that I feel comfortable predicting what we'll see on opener, because there could I'm not going to say that there aren't going to be broods of 12 out there, like we saw, you know, maybe last year, the year before, with a really, really good nesting and brood rearing conditions, but I think it'll be rarer. But the bright spot is if broods were affected negatively by weather events, meaning, you know, a hen can only, what she's doing when she's brooding is keeping the chicks close to her body because she can thermoregulate and they cannot. It takes 10 to 14 days to grow feathers that can kind of help them thermoregulate. And it, in that time, if it's really poor weather, cold or very, very wet, only so many chicks. And as they grow, fewer and fewer can fit under her and under her wings as she's trying to keep them warm. So that's, and I think that's where we do lose some. Certainly, they just kind of peter off as they're exposed to the elements. Sure. And, yep. And we do have really good bug production. Anybody who's been in the woods can right. tell us that. Right. There's a lot of bugs out there.
Do they, are they like a pheasant where, I mean, Bob, you probably know the number here, but I think it's June 10th, June 12th. That's kind of the peak of the hatch in the Midwest for pheasants. Is that the same for grouse?
We always kind of generalize the first 2 weeks of June.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just which, because there
that's
is
when
that,
we got yeah, just clobbered.
June 18th is when we had that like
massive
the flood event up in the Northeast.
What did that look like in the woods then? Nick, you're up there, you saw it. I didn't get to see it. I had friends up in that area and Bailey, you and I texted a little bit about it too, but and you've shared some on your social media page as well, but just trails that are just washed out. I mean, insane amount of rain in the heart of our grouse country up there.
Yeah, I was trying to check on a hunter walking trail on a road that had been closed for a washout the day that I saw my first brood this spring, though. So that was like a really kind of a relief. Like it took me, I don't know, 3 or 4 times as long to get to this trail because I had to go through all these back roads. But in doing so, on the road that was closed right near the washout was a brood of rough grouse that, you know, it wasn't huge. I think it was 5 chicks, but still, that's mm-hmm. that was really nice to see. And but what I wanted to say is there should be more hens nesting. That's the bright spot of the drumming count, is that the population over the winter was very good. And so while there may be smaller brood sizes, there certainly is more hens that tried to, you know, procreate. So
will they re-nest like a pheasant if they lose the entire nest?
Yes, once chicks hatch, it's a totally different story and that they won't re-nest.
That's I've had this conversation with a handful of different people lately, and they're like, no, if they lose all the chicks, they'll re-nest. I'm like, no, if once a nest gets one chick that hatches for pheasants, my understanding is that hen is done nesting for the year. If all the eggs, none of the eggs hatch, she will re-nest. One chick comes out, that's it for the year, right?
That's true for pheasants. That's true for rough grouse. There's some variability there potentially with quail species. But by and large, your gallinaceous birds, I'm not the biologist.
So you're good. Wow. Sounds great.
But yeah, that's the case. They if they lose eggs, that you still got a chance. So there's up to rough grouse, probably 3 potential nesting attempts. So they start with an average clutch of 11. Maybe the second attempt goes down to 7. Third attempt maybe goes down to 3. So you can see the law of diminishing returns. My optimism with the rough grouse is we had such a mild winter, such an early spring. Now, granted, Bailey will correct me and say, well, Bob, photo period drives nesting, which I think biologically is true. However, with climate change and everything going on, that's a little bit different. There's optimism in my mind that there are broods that were born in old enough to fly when those heavy rains came in mid-June, that early nesters, and I think that there was a fair amount of early nesting based on anecdotal reports and my own observation. So I think what we were on the precipice of probably the greatest grouse hunting of a generation, maybe multiple generations, heading into this spring, and we were so close.
Yeah, I don't. It's not going to be doom and gloom. It just right. might be hit or miss.
So you're saying there's a chance?
Yes, yeah. Always.
It's
going to
be good, but maybe not unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, there'll still be a good amount of birds on the landscape, and I think that goes for all the species.
This might be kind of a dorky thing. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in. But this might be kind of dorky. It's just that I care so much about it that I'm looking at the radar those days you know, those key weeks throughout the season. And I'm like circling in my own phone
sketchbook
places that did not get hammered
the
by
I mean,
the
Rangers,
because it could be spotty.
Based on what I've heard from the managers across the state, that is a good way to go, just from their reports. And the reports aren't the end-all be-all, because there's so many different things that could come into play. We're mainly seeing these broods on the roads or crossing the roads. The last 2 years during drought, were they just utilizing those roadways because that's where grasshoppers were, or that's where the more lush vegetation was? Because the drought kind of negatively impacted the bug hatch, you know, of some species during some points of the spring. Bugs hatch for, like, throughout the summer in various stages, you know, and so, like, hoppers are kind of a later summer, and they more prefer dry. So they were saying this year might not be as good for grasshoppers, but that, you know, so, but maybe the rough grouse have, goodness knows that this very wet spring gave the most lush vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
So they might have had better protection from the rain than we could have predicted, but they also might just have some good spots that they're hanging out and not
traveling as much.
Yeah. So we don't know.
Well, going back to the diary, I think a couple months ago I had Meadow Caulfield on my show, and we started talking about her master's in rough grouse and the time she basically hid in the woods and studied these birds for months and months. And it was fascinating. And I had people sending in messages to me wanting more, because it's a bird that's just so unknown. You really might hear it drumming. You might see it walking by if you're sitting in a deer stand, a grouse, but typically it's a gone. And maybe you get a shot, right? Whereas pheasants are out in the fields. You kind of know they're going to be near the egg land. There's a strip of cattails with some willows. Like, you kind of know their patterns. A grouse could be in popple one day, and, you know, in aspens, could be in cedars. I mean, and where they go throughout the day. Some hunters stop hunting in the middle of the day because they're like, oh, the dogs can't scent them anymore. I mean, everyone has their own theories about this bird, but there's so much mystery that surrounds a rough grouse. And I think that's why people are fascinated by the bird. Bob, can you relate to that, or Nick?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, anybody that listens to my show knows that I've been obsessed with the rough grouse for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
For many of the reasons that you've stated, and every year it's something new. And honestly, what continues to have me dive deeper is just sort of this observer of the drumming counts, the spring, summer weather, what we see in the fall. And I do keep my own sort of upland bird diary, which sort of fits in nicely with what MNDNR is doing. So this is certainly of interest to me. The thing that I'm most excited about is kind of what Bob alluded to, in that what this could provide is telling that more full circle story of what hunters did see in the fall, especially when you can sort of adjust that for hunter effort, hours, flush counts, that sort of thing. And my mind is always on grouse. I know this is about other species. You guys are chipping in on that. But, I mean, like what Bailey said, you kind of jogged my memory earlier, in that before we started recording, Bailey mentioned that last year it was a theme of the hunting season for me, and I recall it very specifically. There were so many multi-bird contacts. So dog on point, I walk in and I flush not one grouse, but two, three grouse. And that happened through the whole season. And there was a lot of conversations going on about, did the broods even break up? And I think it was partially those large brood sizes maybe stuck together. A lot of birds survive the winter. We know that through the drumming counts. So I'm a hopeless optimist like you, Bob. Like, this fall, you may go out there, you may have a similar amount of individual contacts. Your flush counts might be lower because you might only flush one grouse at each one of those contacts, but it's plausible that we may have a similar amount of contacts. But obviously, we don't know that until we get out in the woods. That's the idea behind this hunter diary, why we're all here talking. The rough grouse, the mystery.
Yeah, I mean, the more we know, the more, I mean, obviously the DNR needs to know more.
Yeah, we'd love to know more. Yeah, we want everybody to participate, like I said, that is interested. Just something that kind of, like, what do you guys think? We're pretty much all in the same boat, in that we have dogs that are every year getting better. So do you feel like your contacts of the amount of birds that you contact in the woods have gotten incrementally larger every year because you're a better hunter, your dog's more efficient, more effective? Or do you think there's more birds, or because you've learned to identify cover better, or are there just more birds? So when you think about, like, people like to talk about the cycle, and I always kind of cringe a little bit because, like, that's big picture long term, and unless you're hunting 10 counties in, you know, for rough grouse, can you make a pattern? Or was this cover just really good this day?
Well, I think we have access to, I mean, you take Onyx and you can see when an area has been logged, and you can put that information to use if you're smart, and you can focus on high probability areas, making you a more efficient hunter, less, you know, walking a long trail. I just go right to the goods. I don't beat around the bush. I go right to the sweet spot, and that's where the birds are. And so it changes the way that maybe I hunt, but I'm contacting a lot more birds.
That's interesting, because as Bailey's asking, you know, about, you know, dogs better hunter, more, I thought Onyx too. I thought about it, and you're right, like the timber cutting age, and like, yeah, it's that kind of tells you exactly where maybe the highest likelihood is. My mind went to Onyx because I think it provides a level of comfort for the person that's the weekend warrior grouse hunter to go into the woods off the hunter walking trail and connected to their dog. So they are willing to explore more in different areas. And 10 years ago, it's like you put a bell on your dog and you stayed on a trail and you hope that dog didn't run away from your sound.
Look at all three of us right now.
Yeah.
Put your left wrist in the air. We're all wearing a Garmin watch that is attached to our dogs.
Yeah. And the GPS connection has changed the world for grouse hunters because they're not as afraid of getting lost.
Without a doubt. And to answer your question, when I am thinking about my hunts, especially within the last 10 years, like I've been hunting grouse for a long, long time. I've had bird dogs for 10 years. So I really, really separate the last 10 years as far as, it's a way deeper dive. I've learned so much about grouse and grouse hunting through my dogs and just the way that I hunt now compared to how I used to hunt when I was younger. But I'm always thinking about skill development. And so you have to kind of, it's in my mind as a variable for sure, as far as like how productive these seasons have been. I think there was certainly enough of an undertone conversations last year. We all realized that there were a lot of grouse in the woods last year.
We've all been really lucky to have been bringing up young dogs as the populations have been increasing the last few years. I mean, these could be the good old days. I guess we'll find out. Right. But it's been fun.
So slightly different question for you, but we've traded, I think all of us have seen we shared photos after the April snowstorm of 2023, that really heavy, wet storm that just bent over prime grouse habitat across central Minnesota, central Wisconsin. Where, you know, it's 10-year-old aspen are bent over but not broke. And some of my absolute favorite spots, and honestly, across central Minnesota into central Wisconsin, last fall, I know were just chock full of birds. They were impenetrable. Yeah. Like, impenetrable.
Try to get your
dog. I'm not a big guy, but I could not get through. Like, my dog would be on point, like, 80 yards away, and I could not get there. I literally could not get there because the trees, the popples, were just bent over into a snarl. Bailey, will those trees ever like just naturally bounce back and pull towards the sun? Is the DNR going to go in there
forever,
and
what's that?
Those spots are gone forever.
There is a window. I asked the foresters this after that storm, and there is a window in which they'll either do it or they won't do it. Mm. And so obviously in that east central zone where the aspen I mean, that was good aged aspen, right? It was just getting prime.
Perfect.
And that was just the vulnerable stage where they are bent over and touching the ground, whereas the skinny stuff either busted or sprung right back up. The big stuff withstood the storm, but that prime age stuff. So it'll either, the worst thing is when it grows a new shoot right on the top of the hump, like eye height, you know?
Oh,
and that's, I don't know, that's never going to be a productive forest, no.
For somebody that maybe can't grasp what Bob is talking about, imagine your favorite thick aspens where they're what? They're 8 inches, 10 inches, 12 inches apart.
Yeah, silver dollar diameter.
Yes.
So think of a silver.
Typically it goes straight up, so you can kind of like twist your body to get through these. Now imagine them laying bent over about 3 feet high and then straight sideways. So you are 3 to 5 feet high. So like you can't walk over them. You can't walk under them. They're just, it's impossible to move through it.
Right. It's like a turnstile at a stadium that you can't go through.
Yeah.
It's like at waist level, you're just stopped.
Just forests of these just bent over.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to talk about advantage
grouse. And I'm sure that there's broods galore in there.
I don't know about that. I did try to woodcock band in some of that stuff this spring, and you can't get to a dog. It's impossible. And this is for a bird that's not running. So imagine you get to a rough grouse point and the bird has already escaped that cover. Nothing would be more frustrating.
Bailey, I hope it's okay that I jump in and ask this question because you were talking about woodcock banding. Last year was epic grouse hunting. I would say woodcock hunting was not, from my observations and several of my friends that have hunted for many, many years. Woodcock hunting was not as good as the years prior. Did you observe that? And if so, is there anything behind it beyond, you know, woodcock needs moist soil to probe?
Yep. Yeah, nothing official. So just personal observations. I was nervous because I knew that the birds had concrete to probe in. And so when you start seeing them hiding under conifers, because it's that's holding shade, a little cooler ground, and it was a little damper. That's not a good sign.
Last year, right?
Last year, yep. And the fall was meh. I mean, it was a very good production year. I mean, from the banders, we were seeing full broods. You know, 4 chicks is the most that a woodcock will rear. And we were seeing good full clutches.
Last spring, 2022.
Last spring. But I thought it would be much better than it was. And some people had great flight days. You'll always still have great flight days,
sure.
Or migration periods. But I wasn't seeing as many locals as I had hoped.
And you feel like you attribute it to the lack of moisture? So then are you saying this year, get ready, guys?
Well, this year was odd. That's what I thought you were going to ask about. For the banding season, you know, this is not scientific data, but our workshop is held the same weekend every year. And we do it that way because we try to hit the prime hatch time so that all the apprentice banders are going to have really good chance of success going out with the mentors. And we almost missed it this year. The last 2 years, by Sunday of the workshop, maybe they'd hatched, and then we get tiny little fuzzy, like less than 1 day old chicks. This year, like, we were almost late. The chicks were full grown, flighted.
And when is that?
The workshop is the third weekend of May.
So if you say the woodcock were ahead of schedule, then...
But it's documented.
I mean, it's not scientific here,
guys. It is documented that woodcock will nest early. That's not necessarily the case for rough grouse.
Dang it.
Yeah. I'm
trying to find...
Science got you again.
Science. I know. Dang it.
It sort of is. I mean, I don't have a great study I could point you to that says, no, they don't nest early because... a lot of rough grouse research is older now or done in a different state. Like, I'm not going to look at stuff that was done in the Appalachians and say it's relevant here because it can't be. What I do know about woodcock that's odd, like Ken Blomberg put a GPS transmitter on a woodcock in Wisconsin. She nested in Duluth in 2023. Mm-hmm. And the last update I'd seen from the Eastern Woodcock Migration study was that she stayed in Texas this spring. She never even migrated.
Wow.
I don't have a reason for why that might possibly be. I was like, is that a trend? Are they all down south still? Is that why I didn't see as many coming through this spring? Or was the population just a little bit lower? I had no idea because we don't have, there's no way to find that out.
So you've been doing woodcock banding in the spring for how many years now?
Eight, okay. I think.
And what, when you do that, like what information are you hoping to gather there? And what is it used for?
All migratory banded bird data would be to try to pattern or see if there's a pattern of age, sex distribution, hunter success, and like, you know, maybe clue into where they are overwintering if that particular bird might have been harvested on its wintering grounds. With woodcock, most birds, like most banded birds that are harvested are within like 3/4 of a mile of where they were banded. That probably being perhaps an artificial pattern because most banding occurs in like Cass County, Minnesota, where we're doing our workshop. And that is just a really popular county for hunting. So that might bias things a little bit. But yeah.
How about those old grouse studies that were done decades ago that are still being used today? Is there any talk internally from the state saying we need some more updated information about these birds? I mean, clearly there's thousands of people that love to hunt them, rich tradition behind them, and yet we still don't know that much about the bird.
That's a really tough one.
Yeah.
So we have, like, I mean, Charlotte should be here for our grouse researchers. There's one grouse researcher, and she's kind of pretty deep into prairie chicken sharptail research right now. She had a really awesome spruce grouse research project that is parts of it are wrapped up, parts of it are ongoing, a diet analysis part. But there's just so much like whys and hows and not enough people to investigate those things. So that is sort of where the citizen science thing can come into play.
Yeah.
I mean, when we launched our spruce grouse survey, it's an annual survey. You don't have to be able to hear well or anything. And so we did open that up to citizens who were interested in volunteering, and we did have a really great amount of interest in that. And so I'm hopeful that this is going to also have a great amount of interest. I mean, I think people want to participate, so.
Yeah, I think we know that the upland community is a very close-knit, tight community, kind of a family in a lot of ways. And I believe that there will be a lot of people that are interested in participating in this. You know, we talked, this is a Minnesota thing. You guys work for the state of Minnesota. Other states out east are doing it. So maybe we'll get some feedback from our listeners that would suggest, hey, I've been doing it, this is great, and here's why. If you have that, send it to us, because we can follow up next week or the week after with more feedback, letting hunters know, hey, you don't have to worry, they're not coming to, you know, hunt your favorite covers or anything like that, but it's been fun to do, and here's why. Obviously, our goal as a group here would be to, you know, inform people that this is out there. We want what everybody else wants, which is the best habitat, the best hunting experiences for everybody. So this is one way that we can get more information to achieve that. Gentlemen and Bailey, we've been talking for about an hour and a half here. So it's been great. I could drill Bailey and Nate about questions and maybe 2 more hours, but I won't. Yeah. thank you for sharing anything or all this information with us. Guys, do you have any other questions? And did we miss anything here, Nate and Bailey?
I'll just say, yeah, I appreciate you guys having us on, and I really hope that folks are interested and willing. And, you know, like you said, we're going to try and pin this down, and we're asking for the moon here and hoping people participate. And, you know, after we get some feedback, maybe we need to polish this a little bit, but hopefully folks are participating.
It's a really credit to the DNR to, you know, kind of raise the hand and say, hey, give us some help here. Like, tell us what you're seeing. And you just started a while back to go down the road. Like, I'm really curious where people are seeing huns in Minnesota. And I am too, you know, and it, you know, that could be one of those nuggets that this tells folks at the DNR is like, oh, we got more Huns here than we expected. Like, how do we augment that? And, you know, part of it is you don't know what you don't know, but you really don't know if you don't ask. So thanks for asking.
Yeah. Thought it out. I would, again, echo what Travis said. If listeners from other states that have experience with this, you've got sort of testimonials, experiences, positive or negative, I'd be very interested to hear some of those stories from listeners. So please share that. And then just, you know, I know Bailey personally, Nate, it's been great getting to know you, but thanks for the work that you're doing. You guys are reaching out to the Upland community and that's admirable. And I hope this is successful. So thank you.
Next time we do this, let's do it at Grouse Camp.
Yeah.
In the woods. Tailgate talk.
Yeah, tailgate conversation. I think we can...
I'm not going to tell you where I saw my birds, though, Travis.
we're going to move the tailgates a few miles. I didn't
know. And if I wear a shirt or not, that's my business.
I did not know that we're being photographed in the woods.
It was, a very small scale. I mean, there was only...
what are we talking about?
There was a few cameras out. Everything was posted. It was all on the up and up.
I'm going to be on the lookout. This far. I didn't see any less.
How high in the air
study is over.
Well, you get a couple bad photos of Bobby, yeah. But you can't have any more of this. We are done. Oh, you ruined it.
Is there a poster of me at the DNR offices?
You ruined it for everybody, Bob. Take it. All right, signing off for the Birdshot Podcast, On the Wing Podcast, and the Flush Podcast. Thank you all for being here today. We'll see you next week.